Good morning. Welcome to Senate Finance. Today is Thursday, January 26, 2017. The time is 9:02 a.m. If you're joining us off net or online, we're in Juneau, Alaska, in the state capitol on the fifth floor. With me this morning, Co-Chairman Hoffman. Welcome.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Vice Chairman Bishop.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Senator Michicki.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Senator Dunleavy.
Good morning.
And I'm Co-Chairman Anna McKinnon. On today's agenda is the Mental Health Trust Authority's overview of their FY18 budget requests. Is there anything to come before the committee before we begin? Seeing none, I'd like to invite Russ Webb, Greg Jones, and Jeff Jesse, John Morrison, whoever is coming to the microphones. Gentlemen, welcome to Senate Finance. If you could identify yourself for the record for introductions, and then if there's an exchange and dialogue between senators with questions and yourselves, since there's quite a few male voices present, if you could, before you speak, say your name so that people know. And then if you'd like to introduce board members that are in the audience with us today, we'd be happy to highlight their commitment to Alaskans.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I am Russ Webb. I'm the chair of the Board of Trustees of the Alaska Mental Health Trust. I am privileged and honored and appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today representing the Trust. It is indeed an honor and privilege for me to do so. I'm going to start first, before we get into introductions, just reviewing the mission or the purpose of the Trust and what it does to carry out that mission. The mission of the Trust is to improve the lives of our beneficiaries. And we've, as I know you've heard Jeff say many times before, describing who our beneficiaries are, to do that, the Trust duties are to enhance and protect the Trust, to provide leadership in advocacy planning, implementing, and funding of a comprehensive integrated mental health program, proposing a budget for the comprehensive integrated mental health program of our state, coordinating with state agencies on programs and services that affect beneficiaries, and reporting to the legislature, the governor, and the public about the trust's activities and the status and needs of trust beneficiaries. As I said, I'm privileged to represent the Trust, but most importantly, I'm here to speak on behalf of Trust beneficiaries and those who work hard every day to improve the lives of beneficiaries, and I'll start by introducing a few of those folks. To my immediate right is Greg Jones, interim CEO of the Trust. To his right, Jeff Jesse, legislative liaison of the Trust. And in the audience today, I'd like to recognize other trustees, including Mary Jane Michael, who is the vice chair of the Trust. Can you stand, Mary Jane, so everyone can see you? Larry Noreen, who is not here today due to a persistent and unfortunate illness. Lorraine Durr. Lorraine, a longtime trustee, who I know many of you know. Paula Easley. Again, Paula's been here for many years and many people know her. Carlton Smith from Juneau. Folks know Carlton. Our newest trustee, Jerome Selby from Kodiak, who I think many of you also know. In addition, I'll just briefly introduce the executive directors of our statutory advisory boards. Denise Daniello of the Alaska Commission on Aging. Kate Burkhart, who is apparently not here. Kate is the executive director of the Advisory Board on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse and the Mental Health Board. And Patrick Reinhart, the executive director of the Governor's Council on Disabilities and Special Ed. I'm going to depart a little bit from our planned presentation just to say, as I woke up this morning, I had an interesting and somewhat startling realization, which is this is probably today the last time I will, in a public service capacity, address you and your colleagues in the House. My term as chair of the board will end this year. My term as a trustee will end a little later than this time next year. So next year we'll have a new chair, and soon thereafter I will not be a trustee. That realization was a bit startling as I looked and realized that at the end of my term as a trustee, I will have nearly a half a century will have elapsed since I entered public service. And that is a humbling thing. I've been privileged to, while my own career is not remarkable and my contributions haven't been remarkable, the changes that I've seen in the lives of our beneficiaries over that time have been extraordinary. The things that have occurred in the development of systems of care for our beneficiaries has been extraordinary. All of that makes me realize that the trust is perpetual. None of us are. Change is constant, and we will all come and go, and our responsibility is to make sure that the trust works in perpetuity for our beneficiaries and for our state. With that, I think I'd like to turn it over to Greg, who's actually here doing the work. And I'll recede from this and ask John Morrison to come up as well. John?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is John.
Pause for one moment. Mr. Webb, I, on behalf of the Senate Finance Committee and Alaskans, I'd like to thank you for your service. It's been a pleasure to work with you for decades, certainly during my time in the legislature. That relationship may have been more often than in the past, but I hope that this is a volunteer and that you're changing your direction in life right now to do other things in our community, and that it is a personal choice and not something to do with Alaska State statute terming you out or something else. But we appreciate all that you've done for Alaskans.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to add one thing. I want Larry Marin, whose term also is ending this year, actually in March of this year, I want to recognize personally Larry's extraordinary contributions to the trust. Larry has served as the Resource Management Committee Chair for nearly 8 years, I believe. And during that time, Larry's contribution to the trust has been extraordinary. Larry has had, when he joined the trust, a vision of service. He previously served as a trustee in private trusts. Because of his background and expertise in resources, he had a vision for the development of the trust land office to take it from to use a pejorative term, a bureaucratic organization that was focused primarily on passive activities to preserve the trust land, to what it is today, which is a dynamic entrepreneurial organization capable of really meeting the intent of the trust, which was to develop trust land and resources to generate revenue so we can actually make a contribution to improving the lives of beneficiaries. Larry has done an extraordinary job, and I'm sorry that he could not be here today. He has done a spectacular job. Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Noreen is a constituent that I represent. So I would like to thank him for his service. I worked with him when I served locally on Anchorage's Assembly and understand his expertise when it came to land management and a different vision than had been previously carried out in the trust. He had great enthusiasm to try to work on behalf of beneficiaries to produce income for the trust to be able to invest in Alaskans that have disabilities. So a great big shout out to Mr. Noreen. I'm sorry that he is ill today. I hope that I wish him the best in a speedy recovery and overall health. So we understand that. And again, I'll just say on the record that I hope that it was a personal choice, that both he and you are not being reconfirmed and your names brought back before the legislature for confirmation. And with that, again, thank you for your service on behalf of the beneficiaries of the trust and all Alaskans in general. Senator Machicki, comments?
No, just nodding in agreement, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any other comments from other senators before we begin? Mr. Jones.
Thank you. And joining me on my left is John Morrison. He's the Executive Director of the Trust Land Office. As the slide says, we have a leadership change. Jeff recently announced his retirement. We began to realize we had challenges to deal with both internally and externally. The trust asked me to come out of retirement. I had been previously in John's job, the executive director of the Trust Land Office, before I retired. And so my title is interim CEO, and I'm working through those challenges. Probably the most high profile of those is the legislative audit that has been scheduled. And I just want to briefly state what our position is and what has happened in regard to that audit. For several years, the TLO has been pursuing a strategy that Russ referred to that is intended to diversify and strengthen our source of income. Income is the type of revenue that we get that can be spent directly on programs and to the benefit of the beneficiaries of the trust. One strategy has been to shore up that stream of income with investments in high-quality real estate in select markets. In the 5 years since the strategy has been initiated, it's been spectacularly successful. It's generating millions of dollars a year that go directly into income that then can go to beneficiary programs. However, just this year, after operating this way for this last several years, just this year questions were raised, submitted to the legislature, and the audit was scheduled. We take these questions very seriously. We do not like to see a cloud over any of our activities or any of the activities that can benefit the trustees, the beneficiaries of the trust. So we continue to believe that we took these actions with the support of the Alaska statutes. We have paused the real estate program. We're not making any new investments right now. We've engaged with the Attorney General's office to define what legal issues may exist out there, and we're looking forward to the audit. We hope that it'll be an open and transparent discussion of the issues, and our goal at the end of this process is to remove those clouds and find a way forward where we can continue to generate income and do so safely and with the beneficiaries in mind. Does anybody have any questions about that process?
Mr. Jones, I just have a comment. Mr. Jones, we have asked almost all agencies or units that are working inside of state government on behalf of state government or that receive undesignated general funds to find a way and a plan to use less undesignated general funds. So you absolutely... if we have not outlined it in state statute, are doing just what we requested, and that is to use the resources available to you to be able to acquire additional interest income to support the beneficiaries, and you have my support in going forward and changing Alaska state statute to allow you the flexibility to create additional revenue for the beneficiaries of the trust. Alaska's in tough times. People who are facing disabilities experience those tough times every day, if not every hour and every minute. And I appreciate all the resources that you have and the board has in the past deployed on behalf of those beneficiaries. So if you let us know, let me know specifically what challenges you might face or any kind of cloud, as you stated, around state statute that doesn't clarify that you should be working in the best interest of your beneficiaries. If we have not done our jobs to provide that clarity, then I stand ready to assist you in providing that clarity and bringing that forward to other legislators in this building.
Thank you, Senator. That means a lot to me and to the rest of the, I'm sure, to the trustees that are in the room, and we will continue to stay in touch with you.
Mr. Jones, change is hard for all of us.
Oh, yes.
And so different people see all things differently, and everyone that's interested in this issue I know wants what's best for the beneficiaries of the trust and the use of those funds. But we are in trying times, and you have limited choices available to you in looking at the long-term possibility of continued UGF funds. So I appreciate the foresight in board members that have tried to point the trust in the right direction in managing its assets.
Thank you very much. So to the matter at hand is the fiscal year 18 budget. We'll first look at the revenue sources that are available to the trust, and we'll get into some of the issues that we've had to deal with. We've got about $460 million invested with the permanent fund now. It's an undivided portion of the fund, so the trust achieves the same earnings on a prorata basis that the fund that the permanent fund does. Because those annual earnings fluctuate to a certain degree, we've come up with a system whereby we use a percentage of market value of our portion of the fund. We average that in a four-year trailing average, and then we take 4.25% of that market value. So you can see the green line on the chart is where that percentage is today. We've been able to ratchet it up as our percentage of the fund has grown, and of course the fund has grown through a combination of organic growth as well as contributions that we've made to it over the years. And you can see that in the years where there was a significant dip in 2011, the permanent fund, or 2010, I think it was, the permanent fund's earnings were not, in fact, I don't think they were almost nil. That averaging allowed us to continue to take out a reasonable amount of money to continue to support our programs. So at this point, over the last 3 years, it's been one side or the other of approximately $20 million. That we've been able to take from our permanent fund endowment. This is the revenue that we get from the Trust Land Office. John's going to explain where he is and how this is generated and what's happened to it over the years.
Mr. Jones, we have a question on the previous.
Was there a question?
Slide,
sure.
If I could just pause for a moment and recognize Senator Gary Stevens has been with us the entire meeting. Senator Stevens, thank you for joining us this morning. As well as Brenda Moore, who serves on Alaska Suicide Prevention Council. She may be here under the auspice of Mental Health Board or Alcohol Board. I know that she's involved in many capacities, so thank you for your service, Ms. Moore. There's a whole chorus of people who advocate for Alaska, so thank you for joining us today.
And
I apologize.
We appreciate them all.
Exactly.
Go ahead, John.
Okay. Thank you. For the record, my name is...
Senator Matic, you had a question. I apologize.
Oh, sorry.
I did. Thank you. John, if you can, on this slide, you started at a 3% payout, and you've eventually climbed up 4.25%. We've had some discussions about a POMV philosophy. You may have heard about it recently. But can you talk about the stair step and how you got there on the – you talked about a running average. I'm not sure if that's what dictated your draws or not, but can you just talk about that a little bit?
Jeff was the CEO during that period. I'm going to ask him to answer the details.
Senator Machicki, through the chair, at the inception of the trust, the trustees realized that if they simply spent what the permanent fund earned in any given year, that would be a very volatile funding mechanism, and in fact, in some years, we might have no income. So they immediately realized they had to go to some kind of an endowment model. One of the challenges for the trust, as opposed to a private foundation, is that because we're a perpetual trust, we couldn't go into principal. And so the challenge was, well, if you have a payout, a POMV, what do you do in years where there's no positive income from the permanent fund to make that payout if you can't go into principal? So they realized they needed a budget reserve. An income reserve. They commissioned Callan and Associates, who advises the permanent fund, as to how large that reserve should be in order to protect the payout during sustained downturns in the market. Callan came back and said, well, that should be 4 times your annual payout, or 400% of the payout. So the trustees started with a relatively low payout, with the idea that the additional income above the payout would start to fund this income reserve. We were very fortunate in the very first years of the trust, the permanent fund had very high returns. And so that 400% reserve was fully funded within just the first few years of the trust. The other obligation the trustees have is to inflation-proof the corpus. And so once the reserve was fully funded, then they inflation-proofed the original $200 million that we were given in the settlement. Then the trustees set upon looking at, okay, once our reserve is fully funded and we fully inflation-proofed, now we can incrementally increase the payout percentage. Now, for every 0.25% that the payout percentage went up, that meant the reserve had to be 1% or four times that increase. And then once we raised the payout from 3% to 3.5%, once again, the trustees had to wait until they had fully funded the reserve and had fully inflation-proofed, and then we were able to go to 4%. Now, during the period that the payout was 3.5%, you'll notice that the income went down. Well, that was the downturn in the market between 2001 and 2005. And we actually used that income reserve to be able to continue to make the payout during those lean years. And then, of course, had to build that reserve back up when the market recovered. And so we have stair-stepped up as we have fully funded the reserve and fully inflation-proofed. And you can see in the Great Recession, I guess it's called, we are able to maintain the payout, again, by looking at the reserve. This is an extremely resilient funding mechanism that has served the trust well. Now, what the ultimate sustainable payout is a question that has never been answered. The IRS has private foundations required to take 5% of their net asset value, but of course they aren't worried about whether those foundations might lose principal over time, whereas we are. So where the percentage might eventually end up, we don't know.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Senator Jones, please continue.
Next slide.
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson, I apologize.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Jesse, as I look at the graph up there and I realize that, the downturn in the 2008 economy, as you pointed out, didn't make much of an effect. It did cause something on the 2010. But as you look into the future, I know you're having a hard time looking at that, but are you optimistic that under somebody else's leadership that you're going to have a continued upswing, as we saw the Dow yesterday passed 20,000, and that you will continue to have a sizable payout?
Well, I think the trustees will pursue the policies they have in the past, which is we will make sure the reserve is fully funded, and then we will look at fully inflation-proofing the fund, and at that point the trustees will have to take a look at what the prospects for future returns and growth might be, and they may choose to revise the payout as they feel is appropriate.
Last question, Madam Chairman, has to do with the general fund. I guess as you look at that, with this graph, I anticipate that you would be optimistic in saying that your draw on the general fund will be minimized?
Well, Representative Olson, through the chair, of course, the trust authority itself doesn't draw any general funds. But we are, of course, concerned about the fiscal status of the state and the availability of general funds for the mental health program. And as Greg Jones has mentioned, that's why we're looking at how to generate more revenue in order to have more resources available to support you in being able to fund these programs when we know that the prospects for general funds are challenging.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Jesse, but you guys, the board, you guys have been very realistic with the multiplier all along the way, correct? On your percentage payout.
Through the chair, absolutely.
Yeah. Thank you, Senator Bishop. Thank you. Mr. Jesse, Mr. Jones.
Okay, next slide. And John is going to talk about the Trust Land Office a little bit.
Thank you, sir. For the record, my name is John Morrison. I'm the Executive Director of the Mental Health Trust Land Office. As a quick snapshot and as a reminder, the Trust Land Office is charged with managing the 1 million acre land base that's owned by the Mental Health Trust. In many ways, we are a mini DNR in that we are involved in all of the same industries as the state as a whole, and we are also exposed to some of the volatility in those commodities as the rest of the state. In managing the land base, we have five parts of our mission that are found in our regulation. The first is to maximize the revenue. Second is to protect the corpus or the land base. Third is to enhance the long-term productivity of the land base. And fourth is diversify the revenue. The fifth is to do this prudently and with accountability to the trust. So you can see is the first four of our five mission points are to maximize and diversify and protect the corpus. The purpose of this slide is to point out especially the need for the diversity and the foresight of the trustees to anticipate the coming troubles in the commodity market. As you'll notice, at the beginning of the land office, the green and purple lines, which represent both timber and land, were the dominant sources of income for the trust. Most notably, the purple line has, in the latest year, all but disappeared. That's because we cut no timber in FY16. In light of that, we had taken principal income that was produced from a variety of the lines and had reinvested that in real estate, which produces the income that we can spend on beneficiaries, and that represents the blue line. You can see as we get to FY13 through the current, the blue line has grown to a more and more substantial portion of our revenue, and as we'll talk about later, we have some significant initiatives at the moment moving forward to enhance the purple line and get our timber revenue producing again, which will return us to a nicely diversified stream of revenue, which, of course, all goes to serve our beneficiaries.
And Madam Chair, I might add, go back one. I think one of the points of this slide is how volatile our assets are. The land base produces commodities, and commodities by their very nature are very volatile. Then when faced with the volatility of the investments in the permanent fund, that real estate program, the blue that's been added in the last 4 or 5 years, has served as a floor for the revenue that we generate. It's consistent and steady and predictable, whereas the others are not. So.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. We have questions.
Sure.
Senator Dunleavy.
Through the chair, can you just briefly describe what challenges you have to actually monetize your land through sales, lease, timber, mineral? In other words, are you continually dealing with lawsuits from groups that want to stop you from monetizing your land? What are some of the barriers and some of the issues you're dealing with?
Go ahead,
Senator Dunleavy, through the chair. We face the same issues as any landowner within the state. We are subject to both all of the NEPA and other environmental requirements with enhancing land, as well as the state processes to which we are subject. One of the issues with developing a raw land base such as we have is the infusion of capital. We have over time been subject to the whims of the commodity markets and the desire of outside parties to invest in our land to both delineate and then extract the resources, which is yet another decision the trustees have made to over time use the money from the resources to reinvest back into the land base to delineate and proceed with extraction of other resources to generate future income for the long-term generation of revenue.
Senator Dunleavy, follow up.
Just one last follow-up. Yep. Thank you, through the chair. Have you had any of your monetization concepts stopped as a result of lawsuits?
Senator Dunleavy, through the chair, to my knowledge, we have not yet had an actual lawsuit stop our efforts.
Brief at ease. Back on the record, Mr. Jones.
Thank you. Senator Dunleavy, through the chair, the short answer is yes, we have been challenged a number of times. We haven't yet made it to court recently, but we're constantly challenged on our resources, just like any other landowner. And it is, and we have to hit the same rules, local, state, federal. The Trust Land Office has built a tremendous staff with experts that are very, very good at managing this type of thing. So, next slide is this converts that revenue that we've just talked about into income. Recognize that the bulk of the revenue on the previous slide was principal revenue. It has to be reinvested either at the permanent fund or in other investments in our own land. This is the income that we pull from that, and you can see the income from the fund payout. It varies. It's the last few years of that previous slide, and the income from the fund payout, the permanent fund payout, essentially is the same, but the green bar is the income from the Trust Land Office, and that income has steadily grown, and that's really been the focus that we started about 5-6 years ago, and it seems to be working. As the prior year lapses actually have gone down. So you put all of these together, and our total anticipated available funds for fiscal year 18 are $21,067,000 from the permanent fund payout, a lapse of a little over $3 million from previous MTAR grants that have been funded and not spent. The land office's average spendable income is $4.5 million. And then some interest off of invested funds at $283,000. It's important to note that the first three numbers are all averages, four-year trailing averages, and we use those for our anticipated funding. And to Senator Olson's question earlier, we are fully self-funded. This indicates where the money goes. Almost three-quarters of our funds go into grants, either in MTAR grants, which are the funds that go through the state departments, or the authority grants, which we give to organizations, program providers, and less than approximately 17% goes to actually managing the Trust Land Office and the Trust Authority Administration. So we're fairly efficient. And fully self-funded using no general funds. The beneficiaries that we serve are in five basic categories. The numbers here represent about 85,000. It's not an actual census. This is based on national prevalence data. We don't actually count them, but we also don't believe that these numbers are very far off from what we deal with in Alaska. It's a broad range of conditions that we deal with, and a fairly robust population that doesn't seem to be diminishing. The mental health budget bill has three parts: general fund, mental health programs, the capital budget, and the MTAR grants that I've just mentioned. The general fund portion is the amount established by identifying the health services in the general fund. It's generally most of it's through DHSS, a few in other departments. They're designated specifically as general funds, the base of that budget is established by last year's fiscal year.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. Brief at ease. We're back on the record. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can we revert back to slide number 11, please? Under the numbers that you have for chronic alcoholism and substance-related disorders, what percentage of those are inmate people that are in the correctional system?
I'm not sure we have them counted that way. We believe that approximately between, on any given day, 40 to 60% of the people in the incarcerated in Alaska are beneficiaries or potential beneficiaries of the trust. Do you have a number?
No.
We don't have a number of what percentage that is of the total.
And I bring this up, Madam Chair, and for the committee, is that this committee last year, working with Senator Coghill, passed Senate Bill 91, trying to address the problems in alcohol and substance abuse because of the revolving door and the direct financial impact that is having on our correctional system, and trying to address that. And I'm wondering, has the trustees looked at that issue, and are they spending any time and effort and finances, funds, to assist the state of Alaska to reverse the trend that we're seeing in the correctional system?
We are, Madam Chair, through the Chair, Senator Hoffman. That revolving door, as you use it, is a significant driver for our efforts. We have a number of programs that are designed to either catch people before they go through the door or get them on the way out and try to get them directed in a positive lifestyle. Jeff can talk to you about specific programs if you'd like some details.
I think my question is, has the board looked at that, and have they concentrated on that particular problem and spent additional resources since the passage of Senate Bill 91, because there's potentially large savings and assistance to the people that this could affect?
Mr. Jesse.
Yeah, Senator Hoffman, through the chair, absolutely. You'll see in a few moments that not only has disability justice been a focus area of the trust for a number of years, but one of our two major priority areas right now is criminal justice reform. And we are investing about $4 million in FY18 in that area to try to assist you in that criminal justice reform effort.
And my question, I guess, is that for additional million, or what percentage of it do you see as an increase as a result of the passage of Senate Bill 91?
Mr. Jesse.
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, I'd have to kind of do the math, but I would say probably about half of that is directly related to Senate Bill 91 or the related reform efforts. But I'd have to get you an exact number.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. We have several questions, Mr. Jones. Senator Machicki, followed by Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. Of the 85,000, which is essentially, you're saying 12% of the people in Alaska are beneficiaries of your programs, do you have some overlap in those categories, or are we really at that level of Alaskans that are benefiting from your services?
There is overlap. Senator Bajicki, through the chair, there is overlap. And it's, again, we don't do an actual census to try to identify each and every person, but we are very aware that the overlaps are one of the biggest issues that we have to deal with.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. Through the chair, so building on Senator Hoffman's comments in regards to addressing the chronic alcohol and substance abuse related disorders, looking ahead, I see that you're working on, or one of your priorities is Title IV, and I know that Senator Machicki has been working on that bill, so I'm hoping that there has been some efforts to analyze the landscape of substance abuse programs across the state. How do they work together? Are you measuring effectiveness within some of your priorities? Are you looking at tweaking these programs to improve outcomes? Mr. Jesse.
Yeah, Senator Von Imhoff through the chair. Absolutely. And later in the slide deck, we'll have an opportunity to talk about that a little bit more. And in fact, one of the only two increments that we are proposing to you involves exactly that topic of identifying the effectiveness of programs and how to improve them over time.
Thank you, Mr. Jesse. I have a question. It's more global. It may be addressed later in the slide deck, and if so, I'm happy to wait. But with the passage of legalization of marijuana through voter initiative, have the beneficiaries seen adverse or the trust seen adverse effects happening in the communities or in the programs that you're delivering on? Has legalization of marijuana affected our recipients under or your our beneficiaries under the trust?
Do you have any
Mr. Jesse?
Yes. At this point, I think it's too early to start really seeing those impacts. You probably noticed that many of the dispensaries aren't even able to be open because the supply is so small. And I know these numbers are very inaccurate, but I believe there's maybe a couple dozen licensed grow operations right now with a couple hundred awaiting licensing. So I think that those impacts are probably going to be felt in coming years. We have been looking at the experience of other states like Colorado, Oregon, and they certainly have been seeing some impacts from legalization.
Mr. Jesse, just to follow up on that, what does the tsunami look like that may be coming at us, or is it a tidal wave, or is it just a raising of the sea level for a little bit? Do we know what those impacts are as we look to Colorado and the implications for Alaska as this moves forward and in sense of the look at costs for the state?
Senator Ferkel, I think that when you look at those states that have pursued legalization, what you find is a lot of poly-substance use where people are not stopping drinking alcohol and starting to smoke marijuana. They still drink alcohol, but now they have more access to marijuana. That becomes a problem, particularly in a public safety arena where we don't have any sobriety test, if you will, in terms of a blood level or breathalyzer that can really measure the amount of THC that a person might have on board. The police have to rely a lot more on field sobriety tests and other mechanisms to identify people that are intoxicated. So we'll see those areas. There has been some recent research out that indicates heavy marijuana use in young adulthood may be a triggering factor for schizophrenia. So, again, it's a very young field. Since the marijuana was illegal, there was not a lot of research put into the long-term effects of heavy usage. So right now it's pretty hard to predict, but I can, I think, pretty safely assure you that it's not going to reduce the impacts of substance use on the state and the state budget.
Thank you, Mr. Jesse. Mr. Jones, please continue.
Back to there. Okay. So the general fund, I think we're done with this slide. The fund balance from the previous year establishes the base. Then the capital budget is a separate mental health appropriation bill. It includes funds for both operating and construction to provide housing for trust beneficiaries in a lot of ways through AHFC. And then the MTAR grants that we mentioned earlier, these are the slice of the trust's revenue or income that goes through state agencies to spend on operating and capital projects that the trust has targeted. The state has to receive those funds or authorize receipt of those funds just like you would any other grant from another agency, like, for instance, the federal government.
Mr. Jones, I have a question. as the capital budget chairman, then is there state matching money, or is it all trust funds that you're asking for? And if so, this is your one opportunity to, I mean, there'll be others, but it's an opportunity to at least give the senators an understanding of what you're asking for, because GF funds are very limited. We're having to take everything that we spend pretty much out of a savings account. I have been saying we can't make payroll. We're drawing down our savings for almost every request that is being made of us, specifically in the capital budget.
We have, Madam Chair, we have a slide later on that deals with that in detail. Would you like me to move that forward? Or?
I'll just wait.
Okay. The focus areas that the trust has established now is disability justice, which Jeff just talked about, substance abuse and prevention treatment, beneficiary employment engagement, and housing and long-term services. These are the focus areas that determine how the staff focuses its time, how the trustees prioritize funding, and it's how we evaluate partnership requests that come in through the year. And through this, we actively manage multiple longstanding investments strategies. The current priorities, as we indicated at the outset, Jeff is our legislative liaison. So I'm going to turn the rest of the slides over to Jeff, and we're going to talk about our current priorities, our legislative program. There's one slide that John will talk about on the land trade in Southeast Alaska, and then to the details of the budget.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. Mr. Jesse.
Yes, I'm going to go back just briefly to this slide. This is a theme and a web that you will see repeated as we go through the rest of the program issues. Again, disability justice is a focus area, but you'll notice that these next three pieces are essential for getting people to be fully functioning in the community and having a lower need for services and supports, which is they need treatment for their addictions or mental health issues. They need to have productive employment and engagement so that they can be economically independent and a contributing member of the community. And they have to have housing so that they can be successful in the community. When you look at our current priorities, they reflect this in that Medicaid redesign and justice reinvestment are two of our now critical priorities that we are partnering with you and the administration on to a substantial level. And the goal of this slide is to demonstrate how integrated those two efforts are. For justice reinvestment to work, we need to develop a sustainable Medicaid program. And the one we've had, where we've essentially been paying for service, units of service, where the more service you provided, the more money you were able to bill, pretty much regardless of the outcome, is not a sustainable program, which is why we work very closely with you last year on Senate Bill 74 to come up with strategies to redesign the Medicaid program. Justice reinvestment, similarly, when you look at the science, and this came up yesterday in Senate Judiciary, it's clear that, again, for people to be diverted from the cycle of criminal justice involvement, they need those same three things. They need support for their recovery with treatment for their behavioral health issues. They need employment so they have a legitimate source of income. And they need safe housing where they can be secure in the community. One of the things behind the Medicaid redesign effort is to get more flexibility on how the state can use those Medicaid dollars so that, for example, you can provide supports to people in their housing and keep them stable in the community so that you don't end up with them either cycling into the criminal justice system or into API or other not only more expensive levels of service, but services that disrupt their ability to maintain stability in the community. Even a short stay at API can often cause a beneficiary to lose their housing, lose their job, and now we're back to square one, and we're trying to start over in establishing them in the community. In addition, these again are our legislative priorities for this year. Same thing, criminal justice reform and reinvestment. That's one thing that we'll talk a little bit more about in a minute. Our Medicaid reform efforts, the possibility of alcohol excise tax. We will be bringing the legislature some additional information this year about alcohol taxes based upon the questions that we've heard from all of you, many of you, over the last couple of years as that's been discussed. For example, the McDowell Group is completing an economic study of the impact of potential tax increases, what would be the economic impact to the industry, and what would be the economic impact if those additional revenues were reinvested into treatment and support for people that are excessively consuming alcohol. In addition, we'll take a fresh look at the level of taxation at the state level and how Alaska compares nationally. You've, I'm sure, heard from the industry on many occasions that Alaska is one of the highest taxed states for alcohol. Generally, we believe that may be true if you only look at excise taxes, but most states tax alcohol at a variety of levels. So we're now compiling what the total state tax burden is on alcohol, and when we are able to share that data, you'll see that, in fact, we are not at the top of the scale. And in addition, we'll be bringing you information, data, and research about what the public health and public safety impacts are of increased taxes, where in some categories, such as underage drinkers, increase in taxes actually reduces their consumption and reduces their draw on many public services that are funded by general funds because, in general, underage drinkers are more price sensitive. The Title IV revisions, as you remember, last year, Senator Michicki had a comprehensive Title IV revision bill. We ran into some issues getting that whole package through. We were able, with his leadership, to scale that back and address some of the issues around minors consuming and the composition of the Alcohol Beverage Control Board. That was a huge step forward. Again, with Senator Michicki's leadership in the interim, we have re-engaged the industry, public health, public safety, and others, and I believe that we are going to be able to come forward this year with Senator Michicki sponsoring a Title IV bill that we believe will have the support of a much larger slice of the industry as well as public health and public safety. I will tell you that if the senator had not taken the time and the effort to actually sit in on many of those meetings, I think it would have been much more difficult to get to a resolution because he was a regular attendee exhorting all of us to make the compromises on all sides that were necessary to bring as close to a consensus bill forward as possible. So we're looking forward to working with the senator and the rest of you to get that bill passed this year. And then finally, I'll let John talk briefly about the Forest Service Land Exchange legislation.
Mr. Morrison, Senator Michicki has a question. One moment. Mr. Jesse.
Mr. Jesse, just to help folks explain our efforts on Title IV, can you just, we talk about substance abuse problems in Alaska, and a large proportion of what the trust does for our beneficiaries. But we're focused on the opioid problem and increases in other drugs, but can you give us sort of a rough stab at the proportion of substance abuse that's still associated with alcohol versus other drugs?
Yeah, Senator Michiki, through the chair, yes, you're right. Opioid use and abuse has gotten a huge amount of attention, as well it should. It is certainly a growing public health and public safety concern, but without any doubt, under any measure, alcohol continues to be far and away the most impactful drug use and abuse problem for the state of Alaska.
Thank you, Senator Michiki. Thank you, Mr. Jesse.
Oh, did I? I got a little excited.
Mr. Morrison.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this, the Forest Service Land Exchange is an initiative that the Trust Land Office has been working on quite some time. A little bit of history here. As the Trust was originally making selections of land for the original land grant, in the
slide 23, for those who are trying to follow, they've just advanced, the presentation has been advanced to slide 23 that is titled Forest Service Land Exchange. Mr. Morrison.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, so the original land grant, as land selections were made, land selections had to were limited to in a variety of ways, but one of them was the land had to be surveyed, and the land, of course, needed to hold some value. At the time, timber was king in the state, and as a result, there was some significant land surveyed and selected for the timber value surrounding many southeast communities. What we currently have today is a situation where we are seeking to, on a value-for-value basis, exchange roughly 18,000 acres of trust land for 20,000 acres of U.S. Forest Service land. The trust land to be exchanged is located in areas such as Douglas Island, Sitka, Wrangell, Petersburg, Ketchikan, and Meyerstruck. We are seeking to acquire more contiguous lands in areas economically viable and suitable for logging in Shelter Cove, Hollis, and Nocatee. We recently have had new legislation introduced at the federal level, Senate Bill 131 and House Bill 513 introduced identical language, and we will, of course, need corresponding and supportive legislation at the state level to facilitate this exchange. This exchange is a top priority for the trust in terms of the slide that we referred earlier as our timber revenue has dried up as a result of not having viable timber to cut anymore. This exchange will put $50 or $60 million of revenue for the trust in timber out in front of us over the next 10 to 15 years, as well as provide extremely important timber to the timber industry in southeast Alaska to so that they might remain viable while the Forest Service goes through their Tongass plan and their switch to a young growth timber model.
Mr. Morrison, is this legislation somewhat in response to Senator Dunleavy's question regarding community acceptance or of harvesting and the trust is trading land, basically?
Madam Chair, the in response to the question there, it is a sensitivity to the desires of the community, as well as for our mission. We truly believe that even though this is a value for value exchange, there is a difference between timber value and land value, and we feel strongly that the lands that we will receive and the timber on those lands is worth more to the trust than the lands we are divesting of. And
Mr. Morrison, I privately asked you a question regarding what the federal government will do if we change the land, which is one step beyond what will be in front of us with the legislation. Does forestry typically make that land available for multiple users, or is it locked up for specific uses? Do you know?
Madam Chair, we understand that the legislation that has been introduced and the intent of the Forest Service is to take this land into the Tongass National Forest, and they will manage it according to their Tongass plan, which does not necessarily encourage use of the land.
That's There was a chuckle at the table. I won't say from who, but Senator Bishop.
Thank you. Mr. Morrison, in your conversations with the Forest Service, you talked about the Young Timber Plan that they're under review. So are they going down a pathway of recognizing second growth and maybe encouraging logging in the future on that second growth?
Senator Bishop, through the chair, their plan, as stated, is to preserve old growth stands of trees and facilitate a change in the industry to a young growth model, or young growth or second growth model, and they believe that they have young growth trees they can offer, although they don't have any. They've publicly stated they don't have any that they can offer for the next 5 years. They do believe that the industry can make a successful transition to a young growth model.
Senator Bishop, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Morrison. If there are questions, it is helpful for the trust to get the questions early on so that they have an opportunity to address legislative questions. So if you're interested in this exchange legislation that will be before the legislature this year, it is a valuable asset from the trust perspective to be able to, I don't want to overstate or speak on behalf of the trust, but in conversations I've had, there's an opportunity for beneficiaries to benefit from this land exchange and have land available to them for a long-term plan in the future to monetize some timber in a location that would not adversely affect communities that are closely surrounding the current property that has been proposed for timber sales in the past. So they are working, walking on top of a fence is how I like to say. They're trying to meet the needs of the beneficiaries and honor the requests of communities that are close to the properties that they own that would prefer to see it in exist as a forest versus monetized in timber sales. So if you have questions, if there are offices that are listening online, if you could direct those questions to the Mental Health Trust Land Office sooner rather than later, it's helpful for them to be able to prepare anything that you might need for future conversations along this issue. Mr. Morrison, anything else on the land exchange?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I would just like to add, this is yet another example of the of an extremely important project, not only for the preservation of the land base, but for future income that the trustees have chosen to invest money that the TLO has previously made back into the land base. So this is an example of one of the many projects that this is extremely important that we continue with that process.
Thank you, Mr. Morrison. Mr. Jones, please continue, or Mr. Jesse.
Yes, I apologize for getting out of order here a little bit. Let's go back to slide 19, which is criminal justice reform and reinvestment. And I just want to make a couple of points here. Obviously, there's a lot of discussion about Senate Bill 91 and issues that have been raised about it. I would put them into really two categories, and those are issues that clearly are going to need to be addressed to fine-tune that legislation. No piece of legislation that large is likely to be perfect the first time out. We're continuing, as is the commission, to work with the senator on which changes are truly necessary to fulfill the goals of that legislation. The other category are misunderstandings or misinterpretations of what effects Senate Bill 91 has had on the criminal justice system. One of the problems when you have multiple changes to a system at one time is properly determining whether a particular impact is coming from one of the things that you changed or something else that you changed. And one of the other things that was changed that didn't have anything to do with Senate Bill 91 was the bail schedule. And so a lot of some of the concerns you've heard about people not being able to spend time in jail when some think they should is actually attributable to the bail schedule changes, not to Senate Bill 91. I know the presiding judges in the court system have heard these concerns. They're taking a look at that. But we will also be looking at Senate Bill 91, particularly around the areas of Class C felonies and theft offenses. So, but the other point that I wanted to make about criminal justice reform and reinvestment is that reinvestment portion. Senate Bill 91 will not achieve the savings and the goals that it was intended to if we don't have the investment in those services that are necessary once we identify inmates or people involved in the criminal justice system that have needs that have to be addressed in order for them to get out of the criminal justice merry-go-round. One of the problems with this type of reform is that perhaps in some ways reinvestment is a misnomer because your savings don't happen immediately. Your savings happen downstream. So you don't really have immediate savings in order to invest in the services that are necessary to get the long-term savings. And that's particularly difficult in this fiscal environment because you're really taking a certain amount of risk that precious dollars that you may be spending from your savings are going to get you these long-term savings that are crucial if you're going to have a sustainable budget. Now, last year, through some creativity by our chairwoman, we were able to get some of that initial investment by using prospective marijuana tax funds. And so that was, I think, a very good way of getting a start. But one of the problems we're already having with implementation in Senate Bill 91, and will continue to have if we don't make some changes, is if you identify people at pretrial that really putting them in jail, the science behind this is that they will probably not leave a life of crime, and in fact, it could make them worse. And so you go, well, okay, then incarceration isn't the answer. The problem is the answer is treatment, employment, and housing. So if we don't have that upfront investment, then many of the strategies that we're trying to employ are simply not going to be effective. And I wish I could offer you some magic way of generating that investment resource to put in up front. But quite frankly, other than something like a marijuana tax prospective revenues or an increase in the alcohol taxes, I don't see a way other than just sitting down and making the policy decision of whether investing your precious dollars now is going to get you your outcome and savings downstream. But in a couple of minutes, we'll talk about some ways that you can, in my opinion, manage that risk.
Mr. Jesse, we have a couple questions backed up. Senator Michicki, followed by Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks for that description of how the trust is viewing Senate Bill 91. You know, we obviously, this legislature and this Senate supported the reinvestment concept, and we are aware of the perfect storm of other issues that have come about. I mean, the crime rates are not the worst they've been in the state in history, but they have increased. They began increasing about 4 years ago, likely opioid theft related, and we are listening to communities. We recognize issues such as the bail schedule, but the other issues that have come about, and you stated them very clearly, we as a Senate majority and a Senate as a whole, it's a priority of ours, starting through judiciary, to work through those issues, identify what needs to be amended, revised, improved, separating that from some of the myths out there, and making sure that we make those changes that give law enforcement the tools they need to deal with, particularly the lower level crimes. And some of them are your beneficiaries that we are talking about. So obviously, we agree that locking them away has not been effective. It's turned, in many cases, lower level criminals into serious offenders. But we certainly have to ensure that we put public safety first and keep our communities safe. And I think that's some of the struggle that we're seeing with the increase in some of those lower level crimes. But I think you stated it perfectly. I just wanted to reiterate that it is also a priority of ours to improve the bill the best we can to make sure Alaskans know they're being heard.
Thank you, Senator Michiki. Senator Bishop, followed by Senator Dunleavy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Jesse, I just want to go back to your comments just a minute ago. But, you know, is it true when an individual has hit rock bottom and they're wanting treatment that you got to get them in right then? You can't wait 6 months down the road, right? I mean, you can, but we're having to because we don't have the capacity. But those that are able to get in seem to have a higher success rate in recovery. So my real question is how much more capacity do we need? How do we need in this state to meet demand? Because we know what the problem is. You just described it. We all know. And that if we're going to break the cycle, we got to get off the treadmill, and we need more capacity for recovery. And is there a number out there in the world that you work in that how many more beds or seats or et cetera that we would need?
Mr. Jesse.
Senator Bishop, through the chair, we can't give you an exact number, but we're going to be getting closer to that, particularly, for example, as we do these pretrial assessments and we identify right at the front end what people need. One thing we're encouraging now is for OCS, for example, to bolster their data collection capacity so that we have a better idea of how many people in that system need treatment. So the short answer is no, I can't give you a number today, but we are certainly, and you're exactly right, that yes, you want to grab a hold of people at the moment that they are open to making a change in their life. Because if you don't, and you return them to the same environment they were in, then they are, not surprisingly, likely to not only relapse but reoffend if it's a criminal justice issue.
Thank you, Mr. Jesse. Thank you, Senator Bishop. Senator Dunleavy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The nature of the issues that you have to deal with under your umbrella, obviously, I would guess that many of those individual issues lend themselves more to management, maybe some mitigation. But how many of those issues that you're dealing with, drug abuse, emotional, mental illness, et cetera, how many of those issues actually lend themselves to eradication? In other words, sounds kind of silly, but smallpox right now only exists in one lab in Georgia, and they do it for research. In other words, there was an attempt to, they identified that as an issue. There was an attempt to methodically do whatever it took, research, inoculations, et cetera, to eradicate that particular issue, and they were successful. We just had a report come out 3 days ago, and it has nothing to do with the Mental Health Trust, but 3 days ago, U.S. Department of Education came out, and they had done research. Did a lot of research on the money that was spent under the Obama administration for education from the federal side, $7 billion. And the report that came out said it was a complete and utter failure of $7 billion worth of resources. This is coming from the U.S. DOE itself. So the question before us as we get into these lean times, and shortly you're going to ask us to contemplate additional funds, how do we know, or do you have some matrix or visual that will show these are programs and because of the nature of the issue we're addressing, truly they are they're issues of maintenance. In other words, you can't eradicate this particular issue. It really, the program is set up to take care of it during the individual's life or during the period of the however long the issue stays with that individual. Can you also show us, for example, issues you're funding and issues you're addressing programs towards to eradicate, and how gains or lack of gains have occurred there, And if there's another category of mitigation, however you want to word it, but how can we see that the money we're putting in is going to these specific goals of maintenance, mitigation, eradication? Because as I mentioned, $7 billion, and once again, this has come from the US DOE itself, who employed two top research think tanks to research that money over the last couple of years, just came out with a report that said it was just a complete utter failure, waste of $7 billion in resources. How can we look at that as you're going to ask us here in a couple of minutes to put more money into programs that we can see a visual that we can follow and say, all right, they're doing the job, they're maintaining, it was a maintenance issue to begin with, and it's working the way it should, or this was an eradication issue of trying to eradicate, and it's not really happening, and why?
Yeah, Senator Dunleavy, through the chair, well, that's a huge question. There's a lot in there. Let me try to unpack it a little bit. Eradication is interesting in a couple of respects. For example, if eradication is eliminating access to a substance, you know, we've tried that. Prohibition really didn't get it done. On the other hand, we know that there are things we can do around the opioid issue, around prescriptions and drug monitoring and things that that could diminish the triggers for full-blown addiction to opioids. So in that sense, you know, eradication or at least mitigation is something that we can look at. When you mention maintenance, absolutely, for folks who have an intellectual disability, you know, they may need a certain level of lifetime support and services. And the trick there is to find the most economic and effective way of assisting them over time. People with dementia, you know, again, they may need a growing level of support. And so how can we maximize the ability of their family and community to help them so that their reliance on government support is minimized? When you look at addressing needs where, for example, I'm a recovering alcoholic, it's a bad idea for me to drink again because I'm still an alcoholic. I haven't had a drink in over a decade. So has alcohol been eradicated from my situation? Not really. But, you know, I've been sober for 12 years. So, yes, I think we can get you something that will help you kind of break that up. In a few minutes, we'll talk about the Justice Information Center and the work that they're doing, and that may answer a little bit of some of the questions that you have.
Sure. Senator Dunleavy.
20-second summation, because it was kind of a large question. But basically, when one comes to us, such as the Mental Health Trust, and they ask for additional funds, if there was a way to say these funds are going to go to this particular program and the goal of this program is to maintain, for example, and here's the nature of the issue we're trying to maintain, I think it'd be perfectly understandable by people to say, yeah, we get that. You know, you talk about dementia. And so if there's some way you can break those down into categories so we can see if there are programs, for example, that we're supposed to eliminate, call it eradicate, but eliminate, and it's not working, maybe then we can have a discussion as to why. And if you want to change approaches or methodology, however you want to word it, then we have an idea. Mm-hmm. But it gives us, I think, an idea to be able to explain to our constituents why we're taking money, especially in these times, and potentially out of their pockets, mm-hmm. to put in these programs. What are the goals of these programs? For the past 30 or 40 years, that wasn't the biggest question because we weren't paying out of our pockets, per se. But as we go into the future, I think it's going to be more important to be able to say, this is what this does. It's not intended to eliminate it. Because of the nature of the issue, it's intended to maintain. People, I think, can understand this better and probably be more willing to listen to our requests for funding.
Thank you for that, Senator Dunleavy. I'll work with you a little bit on how we might be able to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Jesse. We still have more questions. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Jesse, I think that I'm supporting what Senator Dunleavy is asking and trying to maybe restate it. I would imagine that your organization is already measuring these things in terms of when you look at the programs that you do as well as the stakeholders that are doing similar programs. I would imagine that you're contacting them on a regular basis and comparing notes and comparing outcomes, and that you would measure, well, we saw 1,000 people this year, and of those 1,000 people, this is what the categories of their issues, and this is the treatment that we did, and then this is the follow-up that we have done with these 1,000 people over the last couple years, so now we can see how well they're doing and whether that treatment was successful. And, oh, wow, we have to tweak because we're finding that the treatment is not successful or is successful, so we're going to repeat it or we're going to eliminate it. And so I don't think we necessarily want a 200-page report, but I think that what we would like to see is some level of confidence that you are tweaking, modifying, measuring, and seeing what is working on all of your programs and the stakeholders that you work with. So when additional funding is asked, we know that there's outcomes attached to it.
Senator Von Imhoff, through the chair, you've just described the way the trust works very accurately. Every one of our authority grants or MTAR projects that go through state government all have a set of performance measures that are worked out with the people that are providing the service so that we can get exactly that kind of feedback. On a systems level, the Bring the Kids Home initiative is probably one of the best examples where it was extremely data-driven. And there was a large work group that had providers, state people, advocates, family members, and we crunched the outcome data on those strategies on a continuous basis. And I can't remember a single strategy that ended up looking like it started out by the end of that initiative, because exactly as you said, you have to be iterative and continually using that data as a feedback loop to get better outcomes. Absolutely, as we bring things forward, we'll be focusing on those outcomes and that data collection.
Thank you, Mr. Jesse. Just a comment on bringing up legislation from past sessions. This is the 30th legislature, and this is the 29th, so when we refer to bill numbers, sometimes people start searching for those in the wrong area. So the system of looking up legislative documentation for the general public who might be following to look at the final version that actually passed in reference to Senate Bill 91, Criminal Justice Reform and Reinvestment, you need to look in the 29th legislature for that particular bill number. And I would just say, to follow up on Senator Michicki's comments, that the responsibility of Senate Finance is to look at the numbers. And we certainly saw cost savings in many ways with criminal justice reform and reinvestment. And it seems like the media picked up the cost-saving angle when the real intention of the senator who brought that forward was to save lives. And that is that Alaskans were being incarcerated with no hope really of rehabilitation, because the underlying problems that sent them into incarceration or caused them to violate a law that currently exists in our state, that they would be locked away, and that it was costing the state upwards of $184 a day to feed them and to house them in jail, and that this really wasn't a good idea. And the long and short of it is, that bill was about saving lives. That bill was about trying to provide the right services for the right people to be able to allow them a second chance after they have broken a law and be able to go out and get a job and find a house. And while this committee always hones in on the financial implications to our bottom line, the gist of what the bill was that moved forward through this body was about saving people's lives. And in the end, there could be a cost-benefit to the state's bottom line, but we took that cost benefit and we reinvested it so that those individuals would have a second chance in being able to go home to their families and work on behalf of Alaskans as we go forward. So when we throw out bill numbers, I really appreciate the cost savings, because that's our job. That's what we look at. We look at the fiscal notes. But for those reporters or those that are taking stories away from listening to Senate Finance, our job is to focus on the finance, but that may not be the primary intent of a piece of legislation before us. So there are always opportunities to improve everything. I certainly stand ready to listen to Alaskans about this, but this was about using money that we are already investing in a criminal justice system to actually provide an opportunity for reentry successfully individuals who violate our laws back into their communities. We certainly want to keep bad guys away from the general public, but the level of interest around this particular piece of legislation and the misinformation from the first bill that was introduced versus what finally passed has created the infamous myth and facts that we're trying to make sure that Alaskans have as they make comments on this piece of legislation. So I don't mean to preach. I just know the intent of the member who brought that piece of legislation forward, working with members that have since retired from the legislature and different groups in and outside of our state, that the best of intentions sometimes still have problems, and if there are problems, we will address those problems, but the intent was not to save money. It is what the Finance Committee focuses on, but it is not the intent, at least from my perspective, of that piece of legislation. Any further comments on criminal justice reform and reinvestment? If not, please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Looking at our Medicaid reform efforts, again, a bill from last year, Senate Bill 74, I have to say I don't know in my now getting longer career that I've seen a department work harder on any initiative of the level of complexity of this Medicaid reform effort. There are 16 distinct strategy threads in that effort, 14 of which involve behavioral health. And as you can see, the trustees have invested nearly $10 million over 3 years to help provide the department the resources that it needs in order to be successful in that effort. Like anything, some things are on track, on schedule, on budget. Some things have run into issues that we didn't foresee. There'll be a lot of reporting by the department, I'm sure, as we go forward. But the trust is absolutely committed to this major reform effort because we know, as you do, that unless we can reform our Medicaid program into a more sustainable program, then it will not be able to provide the level of health care that Alaskans need.
Mr. Jesse.
Yes.
Question, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you. Both on the slide on 19 and on 20, the first on 19, it says committed nearly $4 million in FY18. When you get to slide 26, I would like you to explain where that $4 million is located. But on page 20, you're talking about $10 million in reform over 3 years. Is that 3 years in 18, 19, and 20, or was it 3 years prior to this budget? So on slide 20, it's not clear in the presentation where that $10 million of reform efforts years are placed.
Yeah, Senator Hoffman, I'll answer the second question first. That would be FY17, the current fiscal year, 18 and 19.
So can you, and when you get to slide 26, can you explain where those dollars are in 18?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, yes, I will endeavor to do that. I may need to phone a friend in order to give you the details, but I'll give you an overview.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. Mr. Jesse, there has been criticism in the past that when major initiatives happen that the government doesn't really change, that it's still the same show with just a different upfront face, per se. From your position at the Trust in working with programs and community programs across the state, do we see actual change happening at the Department of Health and Social Services? I know they're working hard to implement the bill, but is it a restructure and reform that is being embraced, or are we still trying to dodge and hang on to old ways of doing business?
Well, Madam Chair, again, I can tell you what I believe my and my staff's experience is in working with the department on this, and that is the leadership is clearly committed to major system change and reform. And like any large bureaucracy, it's a pretty big ship to turn on a dime. And to think that there aren't people within that bureaucracy that are resistant to change would be unrealistic. And so what you look for is what's the level of commitment at the leadership level to ensure that those barriers are overcome and that there is actual structural system reform. And I believe that the department is absolutely committed to that. Regularly in our conversations with them, they are looking at problems that come up, and rather than sort of say, oh, well, we've got this problem, gee, we may have to go back and tell them we just can't do this. The reaction is more often, well, we've got this problem, how are we going to get around this? For example, one of the resources that some of our funding is going for, Senator Hoffman, is to bring some national-level consultants in the form of Charlie Curie, who was the head of the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, and his colleague, Stephanie Colston, who have worked with many states on systemic reform. And the department regularly, when they run into a problem, will say, well, we got to call Charlie and Stephanie and find out what are the ways around this, because failure is not an option. I'm sure that there will be some in the legislature that will have hoped for more progress and more immediate savings from that effort. But, I've worked with agencies for a long time, and I'm pretty good at figuring out when they really want to get something done and when we're going through the motions because the legislature told them to do something that they didn't like in the first place. I don't believe that's the case. I think they're working hard at it. When you see the personal sacrifices that people in leadership are making in their personal lives in order to make sure that, these efforts are successful, that tells you a lot. There's nobody going home at 4:30, because that's the end of the workday. So I guess that's just the best indication I can give you of what our perception is of the level of commitment of the department.
Mr. Jesse, just for clarification, when you say go around, you mean hit an obstacle in the road and overcome the challenge, correct?
Exactly, Madam Chair.
And if the Alaska Mental Health Trust experiences any geographic turf wars, I hope that you'll let us know if there's a problem that might be statutory or otherwise. As a former executive director of a nonprofit, I know how we can fight for our turf, and it's hard to change when either the agency or the programs that benefit from a funding stream are asked to do something different or maybe feel like they're excluded from a particular revenue stream. It can cause difficulty in advancing change, and it's not because anybody doesn't want to change, it's because it actually is affecting their bottom line as an organization. And so I hope that the department is able, through the leadership, to minimize the turf wars that are frequent, at least in the nonprofit world, as far as trying to sustain great organizations that are doing great work. But as the state changes, so does the availability of some of those funds in different regions. So if you'd let me know if some of that's happening, if there's some way we can help. Senator yes. Michicki.
Just thank you, Madam Chair. Just wondering, there's not much we can do at this point. With the new administration, if ACA goes away, the wondering if you have someone on point for the potential of what could come out of the new administration and how we might deal with it. Again, I know there's not much to do now, but I'm sure you're focused on that. It's going to obviously affect you, your organization, one way or another fairly significantly.
Yeah, Senator Michiki, like many, we are watching very closely what's happening at the federal level. We're also part of AK Health Reform, which is a group of a variety of stakeholders in the health industry. through that mechanism, we're watching pretty closely. Like anything that happens on a large scale at the federal level, you can either look at it in a wholly negative way. I mean, there's going to be less money. There's just going to be less money. Or you can start to look at, well, what's the lemonade approach to this? We expect that there will be less federal control over how states choose to address the problems that they have. And that presents some real opportunities for us in the Medicaid reform arena because, you know, now it's a huge game of mother may I where you have to go and justify sometimes to an incredible level, you know, doing the right thing in a more cost-efficient way. So if some of that burden is reduced, that's going to be a really good thing.
Senator Michiki, follow up.
Madam Chair, before you give your usual thing, it's, I was referring, of course, to the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. We get generally corrected fairly swiftly if we use acronyms.
Thank you, Senator Michiki.
So I'm going to move past the excise tax. We've already talked about that. I think we'll have more chance to talk about that in the future. We've also covered Title IV and the exchange. So let me move to our extremely modest FY18 operating increments. Obviously, we totally understand the fiscal situation of the state, so we really only brought you two increments that we feel are absolutely essential. The first is the Alaska Justice Information Center. If you recall, we partnered on this before, and the first round of effort that the Justice Information Center undertook was to analyze our current programs to address criminal justice issues and to identify how many of them were evidence-based or matched evidence-based standards. That's part of the results first effort that we committed to. They've completed a number of projects in that regard. For example, there are 52 different projects that address criminal justice issues around reentry and recidivism. 65% of those are state funded. Okay, so there's 52 of them, 65 are state funded, and 57% of all of those programs matched an evidence-based practice that had research in the field. The state contributes $23 million to those programs. And I think you'll be pleased to know that 89% of the programs that that state money goes into matched evidence-based programs. One of the things the Information Center is working on now is determining what is the cost of a trip through the criminal justice system. So when you look at what happens from the time a policeman arrests you and you're booked, and you're arraigned, and you go to court, and you serve time, and you get released and perhaps supervised, what's the cost of that trip across seven different classes of crimes? One of the other things they're working on under their initial charge is they will be looking at these evidence-based programs, checking for fidelity to what has been proven to work, and then looking at a cost-benefit analysis. Some of you may have seen some of this similar work done in Washington State, where you look not only at the outcome, but what did the outcome cost you to achieve? So there might be programs that are very effective, but they're very expensive. And is that a better bang for your buck than a program that maybe doesn't get quite the level of outcome, but you can provide it to a lot of people at a far more reasonable cost? And I think, Senator Dunleavy, this will start to help you look at some of these investments and go, okay, this is what we're trying to do. This is the evidence behind this. Now, how do we judge whether this investment is going to get that outcome at a price we're willing to pay? So that's what the justice information is already charged to do. What this increment does is move them to the next step, and that is providing, beyond just looking at individual programs, providing an integrated data platform for the criminal justice system and criminal justice reform, so that we have a central place where all of our criminal justice data from all these different systems that, by the way, don't talk to each other half the time, can be brought together and analyzed so that we can provide that iterative data feedback to the entire criminal justice reform system. So we see this as absolutely mission critical to getting that criminal justice reform effort done. They are working hand in glove with the Judicial Council, which is staffing the Criminal Justice Commission. And we're very excited about the Justice Information Center. And if I might just add, one of the things I really like about this is, as you know, the Justice Information Center is located in the university. And this is a great opportunity for us to use the resources of the university to help us in a very practical way deal with the very real issues that we're dealing with today. And so I think that's a tremendous plus. The second one is IT application telehealth service system improvements. This is in senior and disability services, and this is what we're trying to do. Is we know, and SDS has really been leading the way on much of this, that we can get a lot more effective and efficient services by maximizing our use of telehealth systems. But one of the things that we've learned is that those systems have to be used and they have to be troubleshot. You know, I was, maybe I shouldn't use this as an example, but just yesterday I was in a meeting in Health and Social Services in the Commissioner's Conference Room, and it took us 10 minutes to get all the video and audio and everything hooked up so that we could start a meeting. Well, we had you know, a lot of expensive people sitting there trying to get the gizmo to work. And that's why Senior and Disability Services is looking at, look, we got to have somebody that's waking up every day troubleshooting our use of telehealth and encouraging people and maximizing our use of this. Now, the initial impetus for this was the tremendous backlog in assessments that SDS had. And they realized that hiring a bunch of people to go fly out to all these places to do all these assessments was just not going to get funded. Even the trust wasn't going to fund that. And so they've been looking at how can we use telehealth in order to get that backlog reduced and on an ongoing basis get those assessments done in a more cost-effective way. That led them to start thinking about, well, wait a minute, you know, if we can get these systems in place and we can keep them working, there's a lot more we can do with telehealth than just do these assessments. You know, we can actually do telemedicine and keep track of people in their home community or in their home, even in an urban setting, and avoid a lot of costly transportation, you know, for higher level services. And so we felt that this particular increment was well worth the investment. We need to support agencies, in our opinion, that are trying to work on the cutting edge of maximizing our resources. And in recognition of the fact that these are such difficult, any increment is difficult to get, the trust has agreed to share the funding for these really core service elements.
Senator Dunleavy.
Through the chair, just for the record, Mr. Jesse, can you just let the public know exactly how much this request is for?
This request is for $200,000 total, $100,000 of Mental Health Trust Authority receipts, with a matching $100,000 of GFMH.
Thank you.
And we have about 5 minutes left.
Okay. We'll move on to the capital budget. The first thing I want to say about the capital budget in the mental health bill, particularly in the areas of homeless assistance and special needs housing, is this is in the capital budget primarily because the major partner is AHFC. But in fact, many of these dollars are in essence operating dollars because they go to fund grants to provide a service assistance to people in the facilities that have been funded in the past. And I won't go through the whole spreadsheet. As you can see, home modifications and upgrades to retain housing, that was one that the governor changed some fund codes, but supported those increments. In the homeless assistance program, there are some reductions there. That probably means that most of, if not all of that funding will go to support the existing services we have, unlikely to get us any additional homeless assistance projects built. Special needs housing grants, again, you can see a significant reduction there. Same thing, we'll be trying to maintain the projects that we have. Frankly, probably not going to see any increase in capacity. In some ways, we may be lucky to hold on to what we have. Coordinated transportation did not get supported in the governor's budget. Neither did medical appliances and assistive technology or deferred maintenance. You know, those are important things. We support them. But obviously the governor, as you are is responding to the current fiscal climate.
Senator Dunleavy.
Again, Madam Chair, just for the folks listening, what is the request in terms of dollars?
For home modifications and upgrades to retain housing, the GFMH request in the governor's budget is $500,000. And $250,000 from AHFC. In the homeless assistance project, the trust is contributing $950,000. The governor is proposing $4,205,700 from GFMH and $2,644,300 from AHFC. In the special needs housing grant, our request was $1,750,000 in GFMH and $1,750,000 from AHFC. The governor is funding that at only $1,500,000 from AHFC corporate receipts. And then the request for coordinated transportation was $1 million from GF and GFMH, the request that was not in the governor's budget. Medical appliances was a $500,000 request in GFMH. That was also not in the governor's budget. And deferred maintenance was a GFMH request of $250,000, and that was not funded in the governor's budget.
Thank you, Senator Dunleavy. Mr. Jesse, if those programs are important to you, you may want to contact my office to see if you're willing to use some of your reserve accounts to fund those. If we eliminate all UGF spend on this request, if you need some spending authority from the trust, if we can't gather the necessary votes, it would be nice to know. I think they're prioritized from what I see, but I'm not sure that the Senate will agree with what the governor has proposed on the use of GF or the use of the dividends from Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. So that will be another discussion, but just if there's a program that that you want to compile all your funds up to protect, let us know if you need spending authority to do that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And with Senator Hoffman's permission, since we're running late, Senator Hoffman, would it be acceptable to you if we brought you the details on the $4 million and the $10 million? Yes. Thank you. This is just a roll-up of the budget bill increments. Again, you can see the operating totals. We went over those two increments a minute ago. The total MTAR in the 18 mental health budget is $8,235,200. The GFMH increments are $250,000. The capital project totals, the trust is contributing $2 million. The original request was $5,100,000 from GFGFMH, $8,100,000 from AHFC. You can see the governor has reduced both of those, one very significantly. And then finally, you can see our administrative costs. The governor did slightly reduce our administrative costs. We certainly made the argument that we are self-funded, that denying us our annual increments does not have any effect on the state general fund, but does impair our ability to continue to fund the administrative expenses of the trust. We are very, both the land office and the authority office are under a lot of pressure from trustees to make these increments extremely small, but we will be approaching the subcommittees and asking that these funds be restored.
Senator Von Imhoff, did you have a question?
No.
Mr. Jesse, I have a question on that last slide. When we look at spend in the Mental Health Trust as far as administration goes, please remind me, you're in the PERS system. Is that accurate, or do you maintain your own health retirement system?
Yes, Madam Chair. We are all exempt employees.
And so there is a...
In PERS.
Right, in PERS. Mr. Jesse, the reason I ask that is that, you know, as we see salaries go up, there is an effect on the retirement system. Whether it's small or large, there is an effect. So I understand that you have the... that you're paying into the PERS and TERS system also from the Mental Health Trust. So, Mr. Jones, closing comments for consideration of the Senate Finance Committee.
I just want to thank you very much, Madam Chair. We just want to thank you very much for the time you've taken, the obvious amount of preparation and understanding that you have of what we do, and we are here to answer any questions that you've got today or in the future, and look forward to continuing our efforts and look forward to supporting you as you continue yours.
Mr. Jones, Mr. Morrison, Mr. Jesse, we appreciate all you do and have done for the people of Alaska, specifically the beneficiaries of the trust. I want to acknowledge your board members who have worked for years, if not decades, on issues important to all Alaskans. We care. We're in a tough financial spot, but together we can make a difference for the trustees that you're representing, as well as all Alaskans. Anything else to come before the committee? We do not have a meeting scheduled for tomorrow, so this should free up a little bit of Senate Finance time for you to consider what you're working on in your offices. On Monday, we'll have Chris Curtis, the legislative auditor, before us to talk about some auditing items. On Tuesday, we'll take up the indirect expenditure report, which is foregone revenue that in the form of tax credits or other direction. On Wednesday, we'll hear from Devin Mitchell on the debt analysis. And on Thursday, a PERS and TERS update from Commissioner Fisher. So that's the items scheduled for next week. We'll post that as soon as we can as the speakers and presenters finalize their confirmation and their availability to present to us. With that, we're adjourned.